folks, and welcome or welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast was brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis, a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's in Australia. He's been living here in Japan for the past 2 decades, 8 years of which he's been actively buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in the city on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So his company has a dedicated loan officer in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions. So you're probably already aware that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or if you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on emil.gorgis, that's E-M-I-L dot G-O-R-G-E-E-S, emil.gorgis at tokyorealty.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so we're back with our JREP panel today. This session was recorded a couple of months ago. We talk about the pandemic-related trend of people moving out of the city and into more suburban and countryside locations. Now, that's a trend that, while not as extreme as it is in many other countries, definitely exists in Japan as well. And it has been intensified during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we pontificate on that for a while. What does moving out of the city mean in Japan? So city versus country lifestyle options, the availability of infrastructures and public services in the countryside, and everything really from internet, medical facilities, education, transportation, English language support. We also talk remote work options and tools, how to conduct the proper research before deciding to move out of the city, and what does it actually take for someone to make that move? Who should be considering it? And we also talk a bit about Emil's family recent run-in with COVID. They all got it and they've since recovered from it. And then we also chat a bit about the very Japanese custom of letting kids transit or walk to and back from school, which is a mind-boggling concept for most Western parents, how it works, why it works, and so on. So good little session there, probably less on topic as far as concrete real estate property related conversations go, but still very interesting, I thought. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
We are kicking off because it's a beautiful spring day here in Tokyo. Yeah, I'm looking at my window. Of course, my backdrop here. It is a stunning day. I've been up since 4:30 though. So
why would you do that?
Well, I'm writing a book. I'm writing a collaborative book actually, and there's writers from the US and writers in the UK, and because I'm right stuck in the middle, it was like I just drew the short straw in terms of time zone roulette. So we had an editorial meeting, so it was just like, okay, Tracy, you're up at like no. So I got up and I was just absolutely hideous this morning, and it was dark and it was cold, but now it's beautiful. So
it is, even though I'm happy with the weather, gorgeous.
Oh, and here he is. He's coming in.
There we go.
So we are already recording, Emil. So we are already recording. Oh, and you're outside.
And you're upside down.
Am I not flipped? There you are.
Okay. But we're actually just having a little chat about how one thing that the pandemic has done has sort of, there's a lot of people who are looking de-Tokyo, they're decamping from Tokyo and really looking at ways to have lifestyle options. And I mean, because things like infrastructure, you know, you can be in the middle of Tohoku and have like gigabit fast internet. So
not all of the time though.
Well, not all of the time, but I mean, it's possible.
Gotta be careful about that.
Yeah, it's possible. So, you know, that's obviously really interesting for people like Matt and Ziv, because you guys, you really look at the rural areas for real estate. and people are making lifestyle choices now. So
honestly, one thing, definitely a pet peeve of mine, I may have mentioned it before, but in a lot of my travels, especially through Inaka, I'm pretty nitpicky when it comes to systems networking. And I'm running tests pretty much everywhere I go. Often enough, you know, there's an interesting,
my kind of guy, I like it.
There's an interesting, it's a problem, I would call it. There's a lot of marketing about gigabit networks and services and things like that. And technically speaking, it's correct. Practically speaking, a lot of the time, the engineers who are setting things up are just sort of, you know, grunts who don't, you know, they know how to plug it in, but don't really know. Whatever, there's any number of reasons. What I'm getting at is a lot of the time, establishments who are advertising Wi-Fi or gigabit networks or stuff like that completely and utterly fail at administering their networks correctly, such that you're getting, I'd say on average, I mean, it varies, but it's not at all surprising if I'm at, you know, 4 megabytes or less per second for up and down, which is actually kind of good. A lot of the times it's worse than that. I tested a network that had a 0.01 Mbps rating and they were advertising services. And so at some point, I have no idea when I'll be able to do this or work with people to affect it. I think that a very important element of the kind of what you're talking about with de-Tokyoing, going to not Tokyo is what I call it, is network accessibility and functionality, and Tokyo getting a group of network engineers or otherwise, you know, people who are rather astute with IT, working with local communities to properly administer and set up their networks such that people like us and anybody else can go there and expect to have accessibility.
Well, I mean, I've got friends who are in like deepest, darkest Chiba, like basically in the
Minamiboso.
You know, Kamigawa, like right in the middle. And, you know, they're getting, I mean, he's a systems engineer, so, you know, they've got 2 gigs to their house, 2 gigabits to their house, and it's actually running at about that. They don't have a lot of drop off. So it's like, you know, he's running, you know, fintech servers and stuff. So it, out in the middle of nowhere, and they have the lifestyle, they pay practically nothing for their place and look out on rice paddies all day. So it's awesome.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like systems admin, kind of scary if you don't know what you're doing, but if you do it right once, you're probably good for a while. So just like, you know, maybe pay $500 or whatever to get it done and then reap the reward.
I want to just touch on, hey everyone, sorry I'm a bit late.
Hi.
I want to touch on the point that, you know, you said it's lifestyle, right? I can't imagine that lifestyle. For me, that doesn't equate to lifestyle. I think just that the city life tends to be, I don't know, I'm coming to the defense of city life. City life tends to be a bit demonized for, why wouldn't everyone want to go about further? And I know you guys don't think that, but just like, you know, the idea of like being out there and moving away from the city, like I don't want to do that. Well, like even at beach trips is different.
I'm a city mouse. I mean, I had Uber Eats delivered to my desk yesterday. It was a sandwich delivered to my desk. You can't get that in the city, in the country, absolutely. Yeah. Like, you know, I was busy working. I could not stop. I was like in the middle of like this massive project and I couldn't stop. So I ordered all Uber Eats to my desk and it arrived and I was fed and watered and all the rest of it. So yes, there is a trade-off, but you have choices. Yeah. So,
But that's really the issue too, right? Is determining what choices you want to make and depending on those determinations, figuring out kind of what your bandwidth for, you know, rural or exurban or otherwise not dead center in the metro.
And whether you can, I mean, we're all fortunate to be in a position where we're running our own businesses or at least very close to running our own businesses. We can actually, you know, maybe because we're foreigners, maybe because we're kind of, you know, technologically savvy, but we can actually choose the lifestyle, whereas there's a lot of people out there that just can't, either or, like people stuck in the countryside or people stuck in the city, right?
There's that, and then also kind of going back to the network thing, There are certainly people who, for whatever reason, do not have the ability to kind of leave the metro area. But there's also the middle ground of people who have not yet been empowered to do so, haven't been educated or otherwise are unaware of certain tool sets or resources that if they were to use, then options would open up. But for whatever reason, they aren't yet privy to that.
Mm. Yeah. And I think it's like in everything, and we used to run into this problem a lot when I was living in Australia. It's a lot of it is supply and demand. Like if there are enough people out there who demand it, then you know the infrastructure will have no choice but to appear, right?
Mm-hmm. I'd say too that's
just exactly an.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say that's exactly to Tracy's point before is what this pandemic has created is now the opportunity for people to go. So it has created that demand that infrastructure and remote working be a thing, right? So previous to that, like no, remote work was some jobs allowed it some days, right? Very rarely we meet someone who's purely in the office. Whereas now it's like you go to the office every day is like, what is wrong with your company?
Yeah.
Right. And we think that, right? It's just completely flipped in the past 2 years. And so I think the tools are definitely there to go, to be able to work remotely. It depends on the job, like the nature of the person's work. Like I know people that are school teachers. Obviously, that's not that's not a thing. But I mentioned sort of like, especially last year, I think when we were ramping up these podcasts, what I was noticing with a lot of clients is the ones that were, like pre-pandemic, they have to be in the office, right? So they have to be in Tokyo. Now, because they can be remote, there's sort of two types of people in general. The ones that always wanted to sort of live out away, right? They don't like being in the city. They don't want to be here. They have to be here for work. Now, because they only go to the office once a week or once a month, it's okay for them to purchase a place further out. Like in a different prefecture and like, you know, not near Tokyo at all. And then there are the ones that they still want the city, like to be in Tokyo. They don't want to go straight up country or straight up rural. So they're the ones that are, okay, I still want to be in Tokyo, but instead of 10 minutes from downtown, I can be 25 minutes, 35, 45 minutes. And instead of being 7 or 8 minutes from the station, I can be 10 or 15 minutes from the station. But they're still city style. Like city people, and that's kind of, it's just allowed people to do these things. But I think right now people are very much aware of the tools, right? That happened over the past 2 years is my take on it. There's anyone who's sitting down thinking, oh, I wonder if I'm able to work from home or what's all this talk now, like 2 years into it, I don't know if they are ready. Like I don't think they're ready to make that transition. The people that are the ones that it's sort of being forced on them, and they're like, "Ooh, okay, I'm already doing this," and now because the whole real estate move process, it's such a long period, right? It's not something that I've got it now and I can do it next day. So it takes time. It's like, you know, a 3 to 12 month, I think, just mental mindset if they're going to make that transition. And most of my clients are families. There's a lot to discuss. It's not a single person just say, "Hey, well, I'm going to go here. I'm going to go there." It's like you got to change, like. Kids got to come out of school, right? Like we have long discussions whether or not we go to Australia, how long over the school year, like will we miss out on 1, 2, or 3 weeks of schooling for the kid, for just is the Australia holiday worth it that much to miss out on schooling? I think, you know, Tracy and Ziv, you guys are probably similar, whereas so relocating completely for a family is like, yeah, a big, big decision, which takes a long process. I think I'm going all over the place now. So the COVID brain is hazy. I'll let you guys get back to it.
Oh, how are you, man?
Have you got COVID?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't mention. Yeah, like the whole family.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm getting better. Yes, that's right. I told you. I'm getting better. My kids had it at the start over the past 2 weeks. Or past 10 days or so. Youngest daughter sort of she was a little weird. We're very careful and whatnot, but you know, when kids go to kindergarten, there's only so much you can do, and then it sort of sneaks into the house. She got it, then the elder boy got it, then the middle boy got it, my wife got it. And I thought, oh, I've had my wife's double vaxxed, I'm triple vaxxed. I got my booster like a month ago. And I'm like, oh, I'm good. I've made it. The booster's working. No, it's not working.
No.
and then, and to last week. So I got it. The weekend was pretty much the worst in terms of just, symptoms and run down and tiredness. Getting better. Everyone else is completely fine now, like no fevers and stuff. I'm still a bit, like no fever today, but still a bit.
Yeah, my friends have said the brain fog, when they, normally they do math and they can't, you can't even do math. And it's just, it's really rough. But fortunately, the one that is going around is Omicron. It's not so bad. Like, it's manageable, right? It's still, you don't want it on it. You don't wish it on anybody, but
it is.
I've dodged it so far. Two and a half years, man.
You're right. It's manageable. We're like, our family's managing it, but I can really see how it can knock someone off. If you're like slightly, compromised, a little bit unwell, not in the best condition. I can feel it getting into my lungs. I had pneumonia like a decade ago. And so I know that lung infection, really bad sort of thing. And it's that kind of feeling and sensation. And I can imagine, if you're not able to fight that.
Or if you weren't really vaccinated.
However hard it hit you. And it's hard to think, like, how much is my vaccination helping versus is it doing anything? Is that why my symptoms are like this and I'm not even more knocked out? I like to think so. Because
I don't want to test the theory.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to test it. But touch wood, everyone's sort of okay and on the mend. But I'm also kind of a bit relieved that we've gotten it now. I've got like travel plans coming up. I'm going to the US in May. We're going to Australia in August is a plan, and Christmas. And I don't want to have that happen right before
a
trip. Then we can't go. I was actually meant to be in Australia now. I was meant to go to Australia for my grandmother passed away, and
that's right. And you hadn't actually had COVID last week.
My daughter got it. Like, I was meant to fly out on Monday.
Yeah.
So Monday of last week. I was meant to fly out on Monday, but my daughter got tested positive on the Saturday. So it's like, okay, so I had to cancel the flight basically. Lucky they did it without penalty, which was good. But yeah, so I got impacted that regard, but thank God everyone's okay. So hey, sorry, this is not real estate. Let's get back into it.
the country versus city life. I wonder how the medical facilities are. How is it out where you are, Matt? If you were to get infected tomorrow, how easy is it to get medical care and get to a hospital and so forth?
Oh, super easy. If like in case of like a serious sort of situation, there's a number of major hospitals in Atami. So I can get down there in 10 minutes or whatever. And there's a number of medical facilities around Yugawara. It's a small town, so they're not as robust as a larger city like Atami or obviously Tokyo. But for kind of everyday or like general medical needs, completely serviceable.
Is it like that in all Naka in Japan, I wonder? Because I keep reading about infrastructures being scaled down as people move out.
No, it's not, and that's a fact. Just like with the internet administration stuff, there's a number of things that you have to consider when you're checking out Naka areas. One of them is medical facilities, another is IT infrastructure. What about education and family services, right? It's not the case that everywhere is awesome and you just didn't know it. There are a number of determining factors that you must research and be aware of unless you want to run the risk of making a bad decision. This is one of the frustrations that I have with a lot of the reporting on Akiya and Inaka as well, is a lot of them really kind of don't touch on the various potential negatives of a given municipality, jurisdiction, or region. Right now, Wakayama is getting boosted a whole lot. And I like Wakayama, but the fact is a lot of the areas that are getting pushed right now are severely lacking with you know, kind of medical facilities or otherwise. And that's not to say that they're bad places, but so far as them being like a reasonable place to relocate for a certain type of person, certainly. But for, you know, as Emil was talking about, for a family, for example, it would be very difficult for kind of your average type of person or family.
It's a kind of chicken and egg though. Like, you know, if you build it, will they come? if you find a really good deal out there and you can survive and enough people do it, will the Shiakshos actually put the infrastructure in to match the you know?
Well, and that, I mean, that speaks to the dynamic problems that need to be addressed right now. I personally don't think that, like, I mean, if a family wants to work with us and find an Akia and, you know, make a move and do everything correctly, absolutely, it's business after all. I don't personally, though, think that families really should bother looking, simply because families, by their nature, because there are children and responsibilities and relation and all of these things that go into that, by their nature, have more requirements than, you know, a single person in their 20s, for example, right?
Sure.
I think a lot of the rural initiatives, by and large, are focused on getting families out there. And I think that's absolutely insane. Get the younger people who are single. And again, Wakayama is going to be a hard sell, but somewhere in Kanagawa, because it's close to Tokyo, you can still have access to all of that stuff. Get younger people and probably more single people, probably also in IT or various, you know, remote work capable industries, out to Inaka. Stop trying to get families. It's not their time yet, right? You've got to build the infrastructure and build, you know, financial viability of an area. And that's not going to get done by families. That's going to get done by more nimble actors. And
what you do as part of your service when you look into a, let's say, potential properties for people, do you also look at the area, tell them what they can expect when they move them?
Oh, absolutely. That's a major part of our services that generally comes in the second phase, although it's in consideration from go. If we don't have, I mean, we gather that information right at onboarding too. You know, do you need educational facilities? Do you have kids? You know, this, that, or like, what are your circumstances? Be as precise as you can, right?
Because, you know, to be fair, not all Shiakshos are built the same. Like, I've been into certain, you know, parts of rural Nagano, and the Shiaksho is really engaged in things like the footpaths. What do you call them? Sidewalks, Matt? They actually exist, and they have, like, you know, they've got all the services for, you know, the people who are blind, for example. So a lot of, in some places, I've actually seen the electrical cables have been dropped underground, which, you know, they haven't even done that in Tokyo. So, but there are certain, you know, there are certain regional centers where the mayor or, you know, the city office is just really highly motivated and highly engaged. And you can just see it by walking around the neighborhood, how on the ball they are. And they're actually, those places have a lot fewer akia because people don't want to move out of there. They're having such a good quality of life.
We interrupt this broadcast, I always wanted to say this, we interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, or if you just need summer quiet to hide away from the world. So they offer a variety of options for families, for corporate relocations, or simply if you're transitioning between homes in Tokyo. Now, the properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They've got fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in, a fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but long-term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed Minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profits, or a holiday home that you want rented out when not in use via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth your visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at emil.gorgies, G-O-R-G-E-E-S, at tokyorealty.jp.
Precisely. And so, I mean, it really is a socioeconomic, and honestly, it's a socio-psychologic issue.
So, socio-psychologic. Yeah, I haven't heard that one before.
Psychosocial, or whatever you would call it. But I mean, it's not just, oh, nobody wanted to live there, so of course it's abandoned. It's no, there's a wide range of reasons that when added together and taken cumulatively equal something hasn't happened, right?
I guess that's in support of your what you were saying before, is if you really want to revitalize an area, it's a very good idea to get not just single people, but like you said, people who can actually, people who have some sort of, I don't know, IT or technological savviness to them, so that when they move to this area, they know what they need and they can work together with local government to help set it up so that then the infrastructure exists for families to move there down the track.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not that I don't or we don't or any, like, I would love families to start moving out of Inaka or out to Inaka, provided that they can do so reasonably and have, you know, a certain level of quality of life. If, you know, they have to struggle and all of this stuff. Again, there's probably some families that are into that. And if they are, that's cool. But generally speaking, a family is going to have a harder time living outside of Tokyo simply because right now the infrastructure is insufficient to support that.
Right. And for those families that are looking to buy in Tokyo, reach out to me. I'll help you buy a house in Tokyo. Yeah, that's all my clients are like, yeah, no, they want to buy a place nice, local here. And we even talk about, you know, in our discussions, you know, we talk about rural and stuff. It's like, oh, okay, what's the foreign population in this particular ward, right? We're talking like wards within the 23 wards. Some wards have more foreigners than others. And then it's also mixed, you know, like you can find it often on the website, but the regular newsletter that the wards or the cities send out will say, you know, the foreign population is, you know, this 10% of like Minato, for example, is foreign. And of that, the breakdown is like, you know, European or Western or Asian. And it says sort of the percentages. And depending on like, so not all foreigners are like the same group, right? You have different ethnicities and stuff within that group. So you may want, okay, one district maybe is more attractive for you than another. So those things, even within the 23 wards, right, we see those kind of changes. Or we're looking at it, oh, I need to be within the Shibuya-ku boundary, okay, or within Setagaya. So, you know, we're on this, you know, scale, we're talking about like prefectures, right? Whereas the same, with a similar discussion that happens within, you know, even just train lines or city boundaries adjacent. I want to be in Setagaya-ku. I don't want to be in Nerimaku or Suginami-ku. Some are slightly more affluent than others. So even just the boundary, and you see price differences just by crossing the road. So, and that happens in all countries as well. So, and in central Tokyo too, just the other side of the street, a lot cheaper. Why? Because it's a different district or different school zone. It's a big thing. And then the elementary schools, like, you know, we talk about infrastructure. You know, some places here, it's like, oh, this town had like their information, they have English information, English support at the ward office, which are a lot of the main ones in 23 wards.
Sometimes in the most unexpected of little townships, you suddenly see like a huge English awareness that you don't see in the center of a big city.
Like there are some parenting groups on Facebook, like for kids' schools and stuff, and people post links to, so sometimes they post links to government websites or municipality websites that have, this is a, you know, the entrance guide for kids entering Japanese elementary school, like just a guide for what to expect as parents. There's an English version, and it is a, like basically the Japanese big fat booklet. It's a full English correct translation of the whole thing with all the graphics and everything. And it's some like, you know, Inaka prefecture has just done this awesome killer job that is not being done low. Like,
those are probably the kinds of places that Matt was mentioning, the kind of Inaka places that actually have, you know, the brain capacity to understand that they need to make it more attractive for people to move in.
It's suggestive. It's positively suggestive. But like we were talking, or still are talking about, it's a complex issue. And so like a lot of the times, like when this kind of thing happens with, oh my God, where'd all this really excellent English translation come from? That's very accessible. A lot of the time where that happens, there's been like a very focused effort on exactly that and hasn't, you know, put in an effort on any number of various other things
all right.
that also need to be addressed. And so sometimes, not all the time, I honestly can't even say half the time, but sometimes you'll find places that kind of look like they might be accessible, but they haven't done the other things that are required. And so really that ends up being a waste, looked at in the short term, it ends up being a waste of resources. Looked at in the long term, like I was saying, it is suggestive that, you know, they're trying to do something. So if you integrate with them and, you know, maybe guide them a little bit, then they'd be open to other initiatives. But yeah, it's pretty complex.
A big one for me, like, you know, kind of I what Tracy mentioned, that what it's a chicken or the egg. Okay, if you build it, they will come versus they need to come first. And then like, well, what is it first? I think I like to come and then expect when enough people come, they're gonna build the infrastructure. The idea is nice, but when you're that guinea pig with your kids entering the school system, and it takes, like, because kids grow quickly, infrastructure takes many, many years to develop. Like, to rebuild a school is several years. So, oh, it's an old school, so if enough people start coming here, or enough foreigners, oh, they're going to introduce the English system. Yeah, not by the time my kid is finished the school, right? So that's the thing that it breaks down when you look at it at an individual basis. Statistics, yes, but for the individual family to make that jump, not at all. So that's why, like when families, always about the kids. So one is just proximity to schools, elementary schools, because they walk, and that's significant, as you know Ziv and Tracy would know. The other one is the, like, just like when you got mixed kids or foreign kids, the concern is also, well, how will they fit in? Okay. And I've got three little ones. And so that's definitely a concern for me, which is why my first house was in Shibuya. This one, now I'm in Setagaya, and still not far from, too far out, because, you know, I want it to still be, you know, I don't want my kids to be looked at strange, like, oh, they're foreign. And like, they get that to a degree. Oh, you speak English?
They get that anyway, right?
But you understand, like, but the kids see foreign kids, like all the Japanese kids, they see foreign kids everywhere. There are multiple foreign kids, mixed kids or foreign kids in the schools, whereas I think it's, and the parents are completely unfazed by me, right? I'm not, you know, easy to not faze someone. Whereas I think if you go out in Inaka, like even my, like, you know, my wife went on a trip some time ago with some friends, some foreign friends, and she went to the Koban, like Inaka, going to a Koban to ask for directions, and like one of her friends, like, wow, you know, white friend was walking up first, and the policeman just like this at the police box, like, you know, like, I can't serve you. It's different. So I think that's also for families a big concern. Like, we do everything for our kids, right? And it's such a big concern. So the idea of even within local, like within Tokyo, I get lots of families are like, I need to be within this area, within this district, within this section, just because that's where we have friends, that's where, you know, there are other foreigners, that's where the school bus, the international school bus routes are a big one as well, let alone out to a completely different prefecture.
Although on that front as well, like with English in the city hall or on the signs or what have you, I've actually been surprised when we moved from central Fukuoka, then to suburban Fukuoka, then back to central again. We've actually noticed, maybe it's because a lot of the foreigners want bigger space. So there were a lot more foreigners actually living in the suburbs and, you know, with the big yards and the big rooms. We actually had a lot more English friendly, foreigner friendly teachers in the school, a couple of mixed kids. And now suddenly when we moved back to central Fukuoka, not so much, right? It really depends on the area, but I guess Tokyo could be a little bit different to that.
Well, Tokyo's just got larger foreign population in general. So anywhere you kind of go, like move central out, like there's still large amounts of foreigners.
Yeah.
Like they're still accessible. But then like if you just go out, like then as you get further out, like towards Yokohama, for example, there's bits where like the German school is located, right? Towards Yokohama. So around where the German school is, easy access to that has a large German population. As I said before, like where the kids go to school, parents will gladly go around international schools or easy access to them, right? The American school out in the Chofu. ASIJ, there's the whole area around it, right? Lots of foreigners in that community.
But have you seen the American school bus routes? There are hundreds of them. There are pretty much anywhere in Tokyo. You're not far from an American school bus. There's so many of them, and they do crisscross everything. But
like the international schools often won't advertise. They don't publish. Like there's no public list available. And for safety reasons, so that makes complete sense. So you won't say, oh, where is it, and see a big map over it. But like the Azabu area has several bus routes that go around, of course, for a lot of the expats there. So they do go everywhere, but also they go more some places than others, right? Sure. They know where the certain demand is, right? So it looks like it's everywhere, but also it's not really everywhere.
I was just looking for a client who was coming for a couple of months and they wanted to be on a bus route. So I was able to get the bus routes and give the pros and cons of the different, you know, my different properties based on, you know, what time the bus was going past. Because it's not just that there's a bus going past, is like, is it at the start of the route or the end of the route? So, you know, what time of the day do you, you know, sometimes you're going to be there at 7 and other times you don't have to be there until 8, depending on how far it's got to go. This is a long bus route for little kids. It's a really long way to go.
Yeah. So like, I know, I think like around Yoyogi, Uehara and Meidama area, there's two routes and they're kind of like the last, so they're the last pickup, the latest pickup and the earliest drop off.
And you know what, interestingly, that's where my houses were.
But like around the Azabu area, there's, it's great. Like the latest bus pickup is like 7 a.m. They start from 6:30, 6:15. Yes. Like they pick up the kids. Yeah, the latest pickup is like 7 or 7:10. And then it shuttles out. But I was just like, some parents though I've met, they are kind of, they're split. So when both parents work, the extra hour each way is daycare. So I was just gonna say,
I don't think I'd mind that much if my son would have left home an hour earlier in the morning
and come back an hour later.
My kid gets car sick. It's just like, that would just be miserable for him to sit on the bus for like an hour and a half each way a day. That's just miserable.
It depends on like the family and whatnot. But there's different ways of thinking about it. So for me, it's like time. I want to be as close and convenient because I think my kids' time is also valuable. Maybe also because I work from home a lot. So the sooner they're home, we get to sort of spend more time together and dinners together and stuff like that. It's a case-by-case basis. But yeah, there's two ways to really think about it. But yeah, even just down to bus routes, lots of clients, like that's where the buses are. And you know, it's like a 7 to 10 year commitment because when the kids entering elementary school, especially if they're going to have like two kids or three kids, right? It's, you know, 6 years for the first kid, and then the second, third kid will come like, you know, 2 to 4 years later. So it's basically, you know, what's that, 6 to 10 year, like say a decade commitment, it's justifiable that you want to live close to this thing, right? Yeah. If you're some people that are just I work in this particular area, so I need to have easy access to my job, that's 1 year. Like they may change jobs in 1 or 2 years, right? There's no real long-term
reshuffled forecast into a different location or what. Yeah.
Precisely. Whereas when the kids are starting school, like, okay, yeah, I'm going to be here for a decade. That's long enough to think I can own this house for a decade. When they move, if things change after that decade, yeah, I can sell it and not feel it's wasteful. I often tell my clients, like, if your situation is going to change and you're thinking you may have to sell this house, this property within 2 to 3 years, or like, yeah, say 3 years to 4 years is kind of that break-even period. If it's less than that, if it's sooner than that, you might not come up on top, because it's about 5% of purchase fees, of closing costs when you buy, 3% costs when you sell. So you're losing 8% in the property value just in transaction fees. Even if the price hasn't changed, hasn't gone up or down, just straight up transaction cost. You probably haven't paid off on your mortgage that much in 2 to 3 years. So if you sell, even if it's at the same price, you may have made you may be down a little bit. It's probably better to think, okay, where am I going to be? Where's going to be good for the next 5 to 10 years at least, to really make it financially viable.
I think on this front too, though, now we're, and again, I'm not like Inaka, like Matt level Inaka. It was suburban Fukuoka where we were living, but still, yes, it was longer to walk to school. It took them maybe 15 minutes instead of the 5 minutes that it takes now. But they were walking along a beautiful road by a river. There were a lot of kids joining the group, walking together. And that kind of made for better friendships too, which I think is a little bit more challenging in the city. Right now, he comes back from school, they're back in 5 minutes, and they don't even play outside as much as they used in the suburbs. They each, you know, run into their house, to their PlayStations or what have you. I don't see them. If they go, they go to each other's place, and again, they're in front of the screen. Whereas when we were living in again, not Inaka, but suburban city, they were playing outside a hell of a lot more.
Yeah, I think it could be case by case. Our school is maybe 500 meters down the road, so yeah, it's like a 10-minute walk for my son. I think even a short walk, like when you walk, you know, so for people who don't know, the listeners, the schools will have a fixed route, a path where all the kids need to walk along, and usually the kids walk by themselves, the parents don't walk them to school, even from first grade. I forgot the name in Japanese. Tracy, do you know the name of those streets, the designated streets?
No, but you do have to, they actually have, like in our school, they've got color-coded routes, and they've tied these ribbons on the side of their Vandersaddle, and so that they know which route they're on, and like to and from walking to school, it's almost like a community activity as well. I know, yeah, that
the parents out there with the flags and
yeah, but some of the small business owners, you know, at 8 o'clock when the kids are walking to school, just happen to be outside watering their garden, you know, just keep, and you know, it's because all they're doing is just keeping an eye on their kids, even though they're not related to those actual kids, they're just keeping an eye, like, as community citizens. And I just, you know, even though I'd live, you know, I love living in Tokyo. I mean, I love the country, but I also do love living in Tokyo, because it does, especially in little areas, in these little pockets, it is like a little village atmosphere here. Like I said, the small business owners, like it was the dry cleaning lady. She always went outside and was watering her garden just as the kids were going to school. She was just keeping a friendly eye, because the kids would be running around and maybe not watching the traffic, but she would always just keep her eye out there. And also other small business owners would be walking along the designated path. And then there's the Wandies that do the level crossings. So, you know, even though the kids are not actually, as parents, we're not allowed to walk the kids to school for drop off.
Keeping an eye on them, right?
They're well monitored.
Not allowed to, because the crowding, and you know, so, and also I think it's to build resilience and, you know, independence. But the first time it happened that he walked to school by himself, I was that parent hiding behind like lamp. You know, he was like, you know, he was six or something, and it's like, I'm so proud of myself, and I'm
being. Funny how they build their resilience and independence in some very specific areas in Japan, while everything else is like just guide them and avoid friction and do everything for them in advance, right? It's weird how they decide which things should be. Like, because the walking to school thing is inconceivable for foreigners in Western countries, right?
Oh, Australia, you would never do it. Like, you would, like, you deliver your kid to the front, like, to the teacher, like, you know, deliver them to the classroom. Yeah. For sure.
There's a first grader, 7-year-old, like, who was in the same kindergarten as my eldest, and his school was being, like, rebuilt at the time, like, he's when he went to first grade. So, he was actually catching a train and doing a transfer to being seven, like it was like a stop transfer and stop, so like two stops, but they with a little transit, and the mum went with him like I think for the first few weeks, but then he's like 7-year-old on a train, public transport, doing transfers. I'm like, I don't want my kid to, you know, to run around the corner. And in Australia, no chance.
Hey, FYI, I gotta go in like 5.
Yep. Right. All righty. No, we're talking. Sorry, Matt.
We didn't really talk about real estate, but this country versus city life. That was a really good conversation, I think.
Yeah, there's article. There was a big was The Economist. There's been a steady flow of articles, which is refreshing too, because they're not directly about Akiya. Because like I've stated previously, I kind of have a lot of problems with Akiya articles. But these articles tend to talk about, they're not using the word migration, but talking about how there has been an uptick in people who are relocating from metro areas, not just Tokyo, but that's frequently kind of the focal point, and out into more exurban, suburban, or rural areas, which are, I support these articles because they're not painting a very specific picture of what they're doing. They're saying like, oh no, actually there is kind of a range of things.
There's something going on. Muted migration, I would say. There's definitely something going on. Not as much as you'd expect in other countries, but there's definitely a movement there.
I noticed on that point, like some friends of mine, rather than migrating, like they will actually rent a month out in like the snow, a villa, and the whole family will be there for a month. And so they're at the snow, and they're working. So they're basically working from home in the snow villa. So they're doing it without overly committing. It's like 1 month of rental. And they're working from home. So they're getting like the benefit, but not really fully committing to being out and moving their kids. And the kids, like now they do a lot of online, you know, a lot of places doing support for online stuff, like the elementary schools have it. So my son, because you know, because that family can't go out, isn't leaving the house. He's been doing online for his elementary school. So that's, now that that's sort of an option, you know, it gives us more flexibility. So in our case, we plan to go to Australia in August for about a month. So, and we've already spoken with the teacher that that's the plan, and they're going to do some online. He's going to basically dial in remotely, and she'll give him some homework and he'll dial in remotely. So there's like, now that that structure, because you know, the pandemic, that structure is in place, it gives people flexibility to do these kind of remote semi relocations to a degree. I'm curious how that will, moving forward, how that's going to spread out. Like now people are doing 1 month at a time, the summer season or the winter season, to make the most of the snow and to get out of the Tokyo heat. I'm curious how that's going to ramp up.
Again, I think a big problem for this trend here in Japan is that a lot of people just don't have the ability to do this kind of work remotely, right? If you think about your typical Japanese, you know, salaryman, the amount of them that can actually, you know, work remotely for an entire month without having to physically meet someone face to face is minute, to say the least.
Yeah, and I mean, my approach to that is, it's sort of unfortunate, but you know, get the low hanging fruit, right? The salaryman, they're not going to do it easily anyway. And while I wouldn't want to call it a waste of time, because that's kind of negative, it'll be a slog. Whereas if you go after the people that currently right now are more able, for whatever reason, to do what Emil was talking about.
Better than nothing. Yeah.
Right. And if you hit them first and they start doing it, then, you know, maybe the dominoes will start falling. But if, I mean, really this comes down to like targeted marketing.
Well, so Trace, that's kind of what you're doing with your staycation. So you go, like, you're going to jump in, Trace?
Oh, no, it's just agreeing with you, just saying that, you know, going for the low-hanging fruit, because the issue not necessarily is that people can't do it, is that they're not the will there because it's not in the company cultures. So, you know, working with a company that's a bit more progressive, like, you know, companies like Rakuten, for example, you know, I don't think they'll ever go to, you know, everyone being in the office again. They're really giving flexibility. But that's a fairly progressive company. Mm. But, you know, you look at a Sumitomo, for example, that is, you know, Zaibatsu, you know, that typical thing. That company, like a Dentsu, for example, that's never going to happen.
But real estate in Japan is a bit...
Sorry, I shouldn't say it's never going to happen, but it's, yeah.
The rest of the world, real estate is always on the edge, cutting edge of technology, but here in Japan, it's very much an old school industry. But sorry, Matt, you got to go, right?
That's going to go.
I'm going to duck out. So good talking. See you next week.
Yeah, see you next week. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Well, that's probably a good place to stop, hey?
Yep,
that's not. Yeah. All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. See you next time.
Okay, hope you've enjoyed that conversation, even though it wasn't strictly real estate related. I know I definitely did. And in case you're concerned, Emil's family is now absolutely fine. Again, thank you. It's been a couple of months since the video was recorded. And have no fear, I promise we'll be back talking nitty-gritty real estate property again on our next episode. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.